And then, die, and die well. He spoke kindly, like an indulgent uncle. That's all we ask of you. Why do you do it? To take another's life is a special kind of thrill, Mirabel. To do it while being immortal elevates the act to an entirely different level of sublimity. He paused, as if marshalling his thoughts. We don't really grasp the nature of death, even in these difficult times. But by taking a life, especially the life of someone who wasn't immortal, and who therefore already had an acute awareness of death, we can obtain some vicarious sense of what it means. Then the people you hunt are never immortal? Not generally, no. We usually select from the mulch, picking someone reasonably healthy. We want them to give us a good chase for our money, of course, so we're not above feeding them first. He told me more, that the game was financed by a clandestine network of subscribers, mostly Canopy. Their numbers were rumored to be augmented by pleasure seekers from some of the more libertarian carousels, still inhabited in the Rust Belt, or some of the other settlements on Yellowstone, like Lorienville. Nobody in the network knew more than a handful of other subscribers, and their true identities were camouflaged by an elaborate system of deceits and masks, so that no one could be exposed in the open chambers of Canopy life, which still affected a kind of decadent civility. Hunts were organized at short notice, with small numbers of subscribers alerted at any one time, convening in disused parts of the Canopy. On the same night, or no more than a day before, a victim would be extracted from the mulch and prepared. The implants were a recent refinement. They allowed the progress of the hunt to be shared amongst a larger pool of subscribers, boosting the potential revenue enormously. Other subscribers would help with ground coverage, risking the mulch to bring video images of the hunt back to the Canopy, with cachets to those who obtain the most spectacular footage. Simple rules of play, which were more strictly enforced than any actual laws which still prevailed in the city, determined the accepted parameters within which the hunt could take place, the permitted tracking devices and weapons, what constituted a fair kill. "There's just one problem," I said. "I'm not from the mulch. I don't know my way around your city. I'm not sure you're going to get your money's worth."
"Oh, we'll manage. You'll have an adequate head start on the hunters. And to be frank, your not being local is actually something of an advantage to us. The locals know far too many shortcuts and hidey-holes."
"Pretty unsporting of them. Waverley, there's something I want you to know."
"Yes?"
"I'm going to come back and kill you." He laughed. "Sorry, Mirabel, but I've heard it all before." The cable car landed, the door opened, and he invited me to step out. I started running as the cable car damped its lights and climbed above me, heading back to the Canopy. Even as it ascended, a dark mote against the milky strands of aerial light, more cars were descending, like fireflies. They were not headed straight for me. That wouldn't have been sporting, but they were certainly headed for my general part of the mulch. The game had started. I kept running. If the area of the mulch where the rickshaw kid had left me was a bad one, then this was something else. A territory so depopulated that it could not even be termed dangerous in the same sense, unless you happened to be the unwilling participant in a night's hunt. There were no fires burning in the lower levels, and the encrustations around the structures had a look of deserted neglect, half collapsed and inaccessible. The surface roads were even more dilapidated